You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Welcome to Earth Station 1, a weekly podcast dedicated to all things sci-fi, fantasy, and much, much more. Sit back and relax and enjoy the show.
DragonCon 2016! Yeah. Come on, it's Saturday! Give me some energy! Yeah. Hit DragonCon 30th. Yeah. Which is, everybody knows, is DragonCon Triple X.
That explains so much now.
I'm seeing some guilty looks out there. Yeah. Yes. My name is Gary Mitchell. I am the co-director, along with Joe Crow, of the American Sci-Fi Classics Trek, which is where you are. Hopefully you're aware of this, where you are, that is. Although, you know, some of us may have started already. So, anyone using the app, I would like to please remind you to please rate the panel in the app. Whoever has been to the Classic Trek panel in the previous years. You remember the old Tetris room? We got a bigger room because of people using the app and saying, you know, a better room because this one's not so good. So, if you like the panel, please rate it. If you really, really liked it, 5 stars. If you did not like it, 5 sarcastic stars. So, we also have a Facebook group. Anybody here in the Facebook group? We have a Facebook group!
I didn't know you had it.
Facebook.com/group/ American Sci-Fi Classics. We post stuff all year long. Panels are born on discussions on the Facebook group. So, and we have a lovely little hashtag over there. Please use it for all your social media needs.
Panels live, panels die.
So, and we are here today with the lovely ESO, which I am a member of the ESO Network on the RevCast and the Rev News Rev podcasting. From here, I am going to throw it over to Director Faber.
Hey, everyone.
Let us know where we're going from here.
You ready? All right.
Suddenly encountered a deadly threat to its very existence. And this terrifying enemy surfaced, as such enemies often do, in the seemingly most innocent and unlikely of places.
All right, kids, this is Earth Station 1, and we are a weekly podcast, and let's go down and talk all about the 30th anniversary of Little Shop of Horrors. Let's start with ladies first. On our right.
Hi, I'm Felicity Kuznets. I'm affiliated with the Flopcast on the ESO Network. We're also at flopcast.net. I'm not one of the regular hosts, but I make occasional appearances.
She's the mayor of Chickentown.
I'm the mayor of Chickentown, whatever that means. And I run the website and show notes and help out with social media. We're also at facebook.com/flopcast and at flopcast on Twitter.
And next.
Howdy! I am Mike Gordon, co-host of the Earth Station 1 podcast, and also a writer and creator. I'm over in the Artist Alley. That's why I'm still a little winded from coming over there, all the way over there in Table 115.
Be sure to stop by and buy one of the new comics. Tiki Zombie number 3 just came out. Congratulations, sir.
Hi, everybody. I'm Darren Noel, and I sometimes help on ESO with the Dragon Con Report.
Sometimes,
like all time. Also, we do some LGBT content during the year for ESO. And I am a podcaster on Legion of Substitute Podcasters, which is all about the comic-y goodness of Legion of Substitute and superheroes.
Fantastic, sir. It's great to have you all here. So, Little Shop of Horrors, it has an amazing 30 years. It's hard to believe that it's that old already. It feels just like yesterday I saw it in the theater for the first time. Yes, I know. Trust me. Feels like yesterday, Darren. Did you guys see it in the theaters when it first came out? Start with Darren.
Yes.
Why did you go see it?
I was a drama kid in high school. Shocker. It happened before it was on TV, so we all went to go see it. It was amazing.
Okay.
Didn't even know it had a second ending until we decided to get the book, and we were going to, like, hey, let's do the play. Oh, crap. Look at this. Holy crap.
Okay. So that's a question of, you'd never seen the original Corman film then?
No, not at that point. This was 87.
Okay.
Internet, no happen yet.
I saw it on TV, man.
I actually found upon it at a con back in, like, 86 or something. And it was actually even before, you know, VHS. They had them at the cons and stuff. And they had it on, like, a reel-to-reel videotape and everything. And they said, this is this horror thing that Jack Nicholson was in. It's called Little Shop of Horrors. It's awesome. And that's how I found it. And then I heard they were remaking it. And it was just awesome. What about you, Mikey?
Yeah, I was familiar with the Corman movie, and I was, you know, when I saw that they made a musical, I was like, what? So that was interesting. But wasn't it a musical play first, or go right?
Well, it was the Corman movie, then it was the play.
It was the play.
Yeah, but I knew it was a play first, and that the movie was an adaptation of the musical, but I'd never seen or heard the musical as a play first, so really seeing it in the theater was the first time that I was... that I'd seen it like that.
Okay. Because I think it was off Broadway first.
Yeah. It was Menken and Ashman. Yeah. It went on to do a couple of Disney hits, like, oh, I don't know, Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah, yeah.
As an example.
What about you, Felicity?
I did see it in the theater as well. I was really raised on musical films. My mom was really into them, so she was excited about this one, so we all went to see it as a family.
Okay. Had you seen the Nicholson version?
I hadn't seen the Roger Corman film, and I wasn't familiar with the ending of that or of the Broadway play.
Awesome. What about you, Gary?
I saw the Corman on Saturday afternoon, like a lot of people my age, just played one Saturday afternoon because it was cheap and easy for TV to get.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I heard they turned it into a play, I was like, what? How?
Mm-hmm.
And then when I saw the trailer, I fell in love with it, but I didn't get to see it in the theater, but I did see it when it hit cable and was just, like, instantly addicted. I was like, yes, inject this right into my veins, please.
Well, it was just amazing because how bright and colorful the movie was, and they captured the era of the early 1960s, and then seeing Audrey too.
Yes.
It's just, that's what won it over. They didn't keep it hidden. They didn't keep a secret, like in some movies they do with, you know, the big monsters and such. Mm-hmm. Audrey 2 was right in the preview. And, you know, singing, you know, starting to sing right in the preview was Me Mother. And it was just awesome.
Well, I mean, it's one of the big selling points of the movie is getting to see Audrey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Both of them.
Is Audrey a Henson creation?
I believe so, because Brian Henson gave a presentation yesterday where one of the, I didn't see it, but I know one of the topics they were going to talk about was The Little Shop of Horrors.
She knows.
It was? Okay.
Yeah, no, it was
Frank Oz.
Yeah, it was Frank Oz.
Right, right.
Frank Oz directed, which he is a hell of a director.
He is a fantastic
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And he was on, he was on quite a role already with this, right? This wasn't his first, was it?
I don't think it was his first directorial role, no.
No.
Yeah, I thought he did Trading Places.
That's right.
Labyrinth, right before that.
He didn't direct Labyrinth. He did associate
because he did some of the puppetry for it.
Oh, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. That was such a fun.
What's up?
It was originally a stage
version. Do you mean doing the film ending?
The film ending?
Oh, yeah.
Well, the original play. Go for it.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
And you are?
And who? And your name? Come on up here.
And who are you, madam?
Come on up.
Speak into the microphone.
Hello, my name is Casey Ryan. I am affiliated with the Anomaly Supplemental Podcast on the Anomaly Podcast feed. I am a comedy writer and an amateur puppeteer, and on that round, musical theater nerd. So, originally, what happened was that Alan Menken and
Howard Ashman
and Alan Menken, thank you, wrote the musical, and it had the original ending where the plant took over the world. Don't feed the plants. They filmed the original ending.
Yes.
And yep. It was test screened, and people hated it because
people started walking out of the theater.
Yeah. Yeah. And
at the end.
Yeah.
How dare they?
I know.
Because Frank Oz had an interesting point where on stage, you know, like with the King and I and things like that, when someone dies, the curtain comes up and everyone takes a bow. It's like, oh, they're not dead! Yay! You can't really do that with a movie, especially more modern features.
Has anyone here not seen the original ending to it?
It's amazing!
Wow, we have a couple who haven't, really.
They made a lot of money by going.
I know. It's definitely a very
It's a bit of a bummer.
Yeah. You know what? I disagree because when I watched it, I sat there thinking, how could they have thought anyone would like this? It's so depressing. And
it's a bit of a bummer. The original ending is a bit of a bummer.
I thought you meant it was a bummer that they
just did.
No, I mean it's a bit of a downer.
Just to interject a little bit, we watch Game of Thrones.
Exactly.
So do I.
What's that?
$2 million
Yeah.
Yep.
Exactly. They had to come back and refilm it.
Where Frank Oz had to tell the guy who did it, I forget his name.
Yeah.
I have an idea. Should I go around with the microphone?
You want to be our mic person?
If you would, that would be great.
Yes. That is what I will do. Awesome. So I am not taking over.
Yeah. You know what? Our work here is done. We're done.
Now,
I will say, did anybody last year they put out the anniversary book edition, which has the alternate ending. It's Blu-ray. It's beautiful. Most people have only seen the original ending in like a black and white. You can watch on YouTube. Get this. If you love this movie, you owe it to yourself to buy this Blu-ray.
It's the color version of it.
It has it in color.
Yes.
The first DVD in 97.
Yes.
This is back to the Butler. DVD's a great idea. They put all these supplemental features on side B, and that's where they had the original in black and white. David Geffen said, produced the movie, said, hell no. He said, oh, I have the color footage to this. So when it's time for like the 50th anniversary of the movie, like say 2001, we'll put that out. And then 13 years later,
yeah, and honestly, until this one came out last year, a few of those DVDs that got out were going for like $100, $200 on eBay. Mm-hmm.
Now you can get the Blu-ray for like $10.
Well, the Blu-ray was my first exposure to that ending. I knew about it, but it was the first time I actually watched it.
Yeah. And it is so frippin' dark.
Yeah. Yeah. We should maybe.
Have short, tiny legs. If you could raise your hands if you have a question, I will run as quickly to you as possible.
Is there anything else we want to cover as a panel first?
Well, of course.
Oh, yeah. We're kind of jumping to the end, so let's backtrack a little.
Well, let's talk about the casting.
Yeah.
I thought Rick Moranis was perfect for this role, for Seymour.
Such a pleasant surprise that he was a good singer.
Yes.
Because casting-wise, he was perfect for the role, but he could also sing.
The Ghostbusters dude? Really?
Okay. Yeah.
At that time, I thought...
he had so much experience, though, with SCTV, and he'd done so much, and he was singing there.
Yeah.
I was pretty much familiar with the man could do. I mean, a lot. I mean, he was one of the most versatile, I thought, on that cast. Mm-hmm. He's put out country albums.
Yeah, yes,
that's what he does now. I mean, he doesn't act anymore.
He doesn't act anymore.
Except the occasional music album.
He's been retired for probably about 15 years now.
Yeah,
because he's living up in Canada.
Really?
Yes.
No.
Shocker, eh?
From the Great White North?
Exactly. He's wearing his toque and everything.
But yeah, I agree with everybody else. And as a nerd in the 80s, I really identified with Seymour. Probably more than was healthy. Now, I'm not as familiar with the musical that was done prior to... did anybody carry over from the musical into the
Ellen.
Movie?
Ellen.
Ellen Green.
Ellen Green.
Mm-hmm.
And she's also done it back on Broadway since.
Exactly.
Yes.
Or not Broadway, but back on plays.
Off Broadway. I couldn't... The thing is, I couldn't see anyone else really doing the role.
I can't imagine anybody else in the role.
Because she's wonderful, and her voice... And when you saw her sing, you could see like her when she starts really pumping it out, her vocal cords and everything, and it's just like, she just belts it out, and it's just amazing.
Raise your hand, and then we'll get the mic to you. Quickly.
She's got short legs, remember that.
They actually did a concert performance version of Little Shop just this past year with, I think, Jake Gyllenhaal
with Seymour.
Seymour.
Oh, it was like a stage reading type of scenario.
And
sort of like the thing they did of Sweeney with...
Yeah.
Emma Thompson,
yes.
Yes.
And that, I would kill to get a copy of that on DVD.
So to speak.
No, the Sweeney Todd one.
Not yet.
Sorry. Little Shop is not. But you could find it.
That's on YouTube.
There was a recording that, you know, snuck out from one of the performances. And every time that she began to sing, you couldn't hear anything because people just applauded for like 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Right.
My favorite thing about her is how, as Audrey, she's so small and quiet.
And she even
and then
squeaks.
When she sings,
squeaks.
It's an explosion.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great juxtaposition of her character because she kind of talks like this and old Seymour. And then her belt is a little bit like 80s power ballad.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's a great juxtaposition because I like to say that when her power comes out, especially during Suddenly Seymour, that's when you get to see what's really inside of her.
Mm-hmm. Oh, hey.
I'm a theater major. This is where my degree is finally working for me.
You want to keep going? No.
Anyone else up here have thoughts on Ellen?
Just that there's no one else who can do that role.
No, agreed.
Yeah, there's so much emotion in her voice when she sings. And I remember, you know, reading an article at the time, you know, seeing a picture of her, how she really looks, and, you know, nothing like she's made up to look in the movie, but I was just, you know, impressed by that sheer fact alone, that physically she really transformed herself.
Oh, big time. It was just like, because she doesn't look anything like that, and how they made her look with the blonde wig and the pale skin, it's just like...
And the corset work.
The corset work, yes. Yeah. Wow.
And I get who it was, but someone told her while they were filming, if they had stuck with the original ending, they were like, when they did the filming of the original ending, somebody came up to her afterwards and said, "You're getting an Oscar nod for this."
She should have.
Yeah.
She should have, even without the original.
Yes.
Yeah, because there is that last, well, we'll get to it later, but there is, you know, kind of a last little reprise of Somewhere the
Somewhere
Screen.
Somewhere the Screen that tears your heart out.
That's one of the most depressing things I've ever seen.
Yes.
It's funny, though, because with her doing the role, I think anyone else in that movie could have been replaced.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And but not her. Yeah. And that's just the strength of her character and how strong she was, it just makes it that way.
Well, I mean, from what I understand, I mean, she had the most experience playing that role of anybody. So
oh, I know, but...
She's still doing it.
She owned it. Exactly, but she's still doing it, but... How strong of a character she was, because I could see anybody being... We joked around it before we started recording, who we'd want to see in a remake, and none of us could replace her.
No.
And that's amazing with it.
Yeah, something right here.
Yeah, in addition to the great performances the actors give, I mean, the music itself is so iconic. I mean, almost every song you can sing along to. You know, I mean, almost any song could be an audition song if you're into that. So maybe you can talk a little bit about the music and the qualities of the music.
Well, as a theater geek like you, I can speak to the fact that this movie does something really good that a lot of people who don't go to see theater may not understand or recognize off the bat, but when you go to see other movies, you'll be like, ah, I see what they did there. The urchins being the Greek chorus characters, their through line, just they're part of the world, they're not part of the world, they're in it, they're out of it. There's some Brechtian stuff going on there, and it's really interesting to see them interact with, like, they know that this person's gonna die, they're singing along with what's going on, but they're not interacting, they're not preventing it, they're just over here somewhere, and then they sing subsequent to the events in the original ending, which is like, oh well, humanity, fuck you. Yeah. Oh, explicit tag. There you go.
All right.
So. Yay. Now I can do it.
I think it's good that you guys said that because I feel like the doo-wop girls, I felt they were like the heartbeat of this.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Well, they carry the
whole story through.
And that's the proper Greek tale, was the
Sirens, a proper Greek tragedy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like the way they play dual roles as well, especially in the beginning of the Skid Row song when you see them as their
in-story
characters.
Yeah.
And then you focus on the woman coming down the alley singing, and then you switch to the other side of the alley, and they're back.
They're in their glamour outfits.
And
their exactly.
I think that's an example of really excellent directing by Frank Oz. Right.
They were the Supremes.
I had seen the Corman version first, and I can't even imagine what drugs somebody was doing when they were watching the Corman version to go, this would make an excellent Greek tragedy musical.
If I remember, it was like almost on a dare.
It sounds like it.
It may have been, but the rights had to be extremely cheap.
Oh, yeah. The original movie was done on a dare. It's like,
yeah,
I bet you can't make a movie in 2 days.
Yeah, it was Corman who found out. It was like, Corman, who's incredibly cheap.
Yeah.
That's Corman's the thief anyway. It's like, 2 days?
That's a day too long.
That's two movies for me.
That's an eternity.
I'd go way over budget.
Yeah, he was told, we finished our movie early, we got 2 days, and he's like, great, we'll do something else. And he got told, no, there's no way you can do it in 2 days. He literally wrote the script, cast it, filmed it, that's it, in 2 days. He spent like $10,000.
Wow.
A lot of people like to make fun of Corman movies, and it's easy because some of them deserve to be made fun of.
The material writes itself, sir.
Corman makes fun of Corman movies.
But yeah, you look at his technique and his speed, and the people, the directors that have come out of his school afterwards, Jim Cameron, Ron Howard, mainly because anybody who came up to him and said, I want to direct a movie, and he's like, will you do it for cheap? They go, yes. He says, here's your camera.
Exactly.
De Palma, I think.
De Palma.
Yeah.
So getting back on track.
It was pretty brilliant of them to make Audrey a puppet.
Yes.
Right from the beginning. And because it was not done that well in the Corman version.
No, it's a very bad puppet.
Yeah, exactly. And
although I do have to say at the ending, which if anybody doesn't know, the ending of the original Corman movie, the plant is getting ready to flower, and all these plant people come in to see this really bad plant or interesting plant. The bud flowers open up, and all everybody that Audrey has eaten's face is in the.
Including Seymour.
The buds.
Including Seymour.
Yeah.
And the last line of the movie is the kind of a force in on his face with his recurring line to the whole movie is, I didn't mean it!
Also, that's how the original stage production was staged as well.
Yes.
And because when one of the flowers opens during Don't Feed the Plants, you see a Seymour, you see Mush, maybe you see the dentist, you see Audrey. And I don't know maybe why they didn't do that for the movie. Maybe it would have been too campy. But
probably.
The movie itself is kind of campy, and it's also a musical.
Yeah. I think that's a little bit too far to have gone, but there's an allusion to that in the original ending of the film when the plant, you know, is about to eat Audrey. It tells her, you know, Mushnik and the dentist are already inside me. You can be too. And when she sings the reprise of Somewhere That's Green, she's talking about being part of the plant so she can still be near Seymour after she's gone.
I can make you sad right now.
Oh, no.
And if I'm in the plant, then I'm part of the plant. So in a way, we'll always be together.
Oh.
Stop it, you.
Stop it. No, all right. I'm seeing Stuart today.
So, yeah, getting back, where were we?
We're talking about the puppetry.
Yes, the puppetry. Puppetry is amazing, and it's Frank Oz.
Yes.
And the fact that they filmed the plant, they were going at, like, what, half speed, if I remember correctly?
I think so.
The acting first out of... Rick Moranis having to do that half speed singing, keeping with it.
Exactly.
And you don't, until you find out about it,
you don't know that.
It's just, it's seamless.
Mm-hmm.
And that was part of the charm of the movie, is just how well he interacted with the puppets.
He did.
Mm-hmm. So.
I still want a little tiny baby Audrey that'll go,
stop it, stop it.
Listen, you.
Yeah.
And Chenoweth.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Guy Stubbs.
Oh, he was awesome.
For those of you old enough, he did I'm Just a Bill from the Schoolhouse
Rock. Yeah.
He makes that movie with everybody else.
And what other band, what music group was he part of, sir?
The Quartets.
What music group? I was testing him. I knew you guys knew.
We knew you knew.
Yeah. It's awesome. And because Levi Stubbs was just amazing as Audrey. And just his voice and then the singing, it was just how it went right into it, was just fabulous. And if they had to cast another male, I couldn't see them trying to get someone with that kind of voice. Yeah.
So I'm curious if anybody knows the story behind how Levi Stubbs got involved in the project. I also feel like, I mean, he really makes that part.
They ask him?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just wondering if anybody happens to, I mean, was there a story behind it? Because, you know, if you think of all of the R&B singers and the soul singers, I mean, there's a lot of groups that you can kind of choose from to have a very soulful and, you know, voice and... Just wondered if anybody knew if there was a story behind that, where they were able to pick him up and determine that he would be the best voice behind that.
What people don't realize?
Hold on. She's running.
She's got little legs.
You had a lot of groups that were very baritone singers. R&B is a very. There's only a handful at the time. So even today, it's fewer now than. More than so, he was just one of the, he was really the top baritone. He had a deep, strong voice. He was only like 5 3, you know, 4 people could have presentations 4 times.
It was interesting because when I saw it at the theater for the first time, they must have had the bass turned up, and when Audrey was talking, it shook the theater. Yeah, it was awesome.
Did you see the original theater on Broadway?
No, he's talking movie theater.
I'm talking movie.
Movie, yeah.
Yeah. So, and it was just amazing to hear him speak and the theater shaking when he spoke, first with the Feed Me and then when he started singing, and then when he was tearing apart the flower shop. Mm-hmm. It was just literally, you felt the seats rumble. And that's what it was just an amazing experience.
Or during, you know, he looks like plant food to me in the pots.
Yeah. Exactly.
The pots jumping up.
It almost felt like I was hopping out of the seat with it. But it was great. I loved the different characters they had in it, too. Mushnick was awesome. Mm-hmm.
Christopher Guest's cameo, basically.
Uh-huh.
I'd forgotten that was Christopher Guest until I watched the film again. Yeah. Oh, yeah, because he doesn't look like you normally see him.
But he's perfect.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, Steve Martin.
Yes.
As the dentist.
And John Candy as the radio.
Radio announcer. World radio.
And poor Jim Belushi.
Yep.
Yeah, that was something else that I had forgotten. Well, I had only seen the alternate ending once until watching it just before this. But yeah, that part was played by... Remind me of the actor's name in the original ending. It was a different actor in the original ending.
I forget. I mean, he's gotten a lot of parts.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a big character. And then he was just busy filming something else, so they couldn't get him back.
Right,
yeah.
And they needed to do the reshoots. They brought in Jim Belushi.
Because he had nothing going on. That seems to be standard for him. I will say, I like Jim Belushi, and I especially respect him for at one point he was being some sort of interview, and he said, "Look, I understand. You wish I was my brother. So do I." Yeah. Get over it.
I'm looking it up as we speak, so keep going.
Okay.
You have signal?
Of course I do.
Sweet.
I'm Director Faber. Of course I do.
So kind of focusing in on the movie then for each of us, let's go favorite scene, or at least, or favorite song, or both, if they're not
all
the
above.
Ooh. Yeah, right. Is your favorite scene have your favorite song?
Well, since we just brought up Steve Martin, I mean, that number to me is just magic. And I think at the time too, Steve needed kind of a boost.
Yeah.
I think he had a couple of films that didn't do so well or whatever. So I'm taking the part, you know, this bit part, because he wasn't doing like cameos anymore. So, and he wasn't known as a song and dance man either, even though we knew he was capable of that. Just to have him in this number and just be, you know, reveling in his sadistic behavior was just, every time I go to the dentist, I think of him. Every time.
He completely throws himself into that role.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, because, I mean, yes, you, at first you're like, oh, it's Steve Martin, you know, but after a while you're like, no, this is just a mean, scary dentist.
I think my favorite scene and song is Skid Row, because it's a great translation of, like, a Broadway-style number where you have lots of people singing different parts, and then the song all comes together. Especially, I like the counterpoint between Seymour's part and Audrey's part, because they're both dreaming their way out of Skid Row. So that's the one that really gets to me.
Well, that's good.
And it really explains and sets up their characters and the conflict of the whole movie, of getting out of there.
Well, that gets the whole Broadway production started, and the feel for the movie. Yeah. It's like, this is based off of musical play, and that's where you get the feel for it.
Yeah, and I think it's just, like I said before, it's really well directed by Frank Oz as well.
Yeah.
What about you, Darren?
Well, Skid Row is extremely pivotal, but there's something in musical theater called the What If song, which Skid Row is a What If song. If you buy the premise that Seymour and or Audrey is the protagonist of Little Shop of Horrors, I don't buy that, believe it or not. For me, Feed Me is the What If song, because Audrey is the protagonist of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because it's not that Audrey's the villain. Audrey, the action of Audrey is what puts all this stuff into motion. Audrey's the one affecting everything. Seymour and Audrey and Mushnick and the dentist are just peripheral characters who are part of the web, and Audrey is the main focus of the movie.
Especially if you go with the original ending.
Exactly.
It gets a little subverted if you with the way the movie ended up.
For me?
Go ahead.
Nah. Go ahead, sir.
Suddenly Seymour.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't hear that song without nearly breaking into tears every time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just that connection. And yes, there are parts of the song in the story that are problematic today. Think about it. But I don't care. It's a great song. Mm-hmm. And like I said, it's just, as someone who identified with, I'm just looking for someone to love.
Right.
And just that, the pure, I mean, yes, Audrey is a character. There's an innocence about her in that song that we see, that why he loves her, and that these poor, broken, misunderstood people who feel they don't deserve to find someone.
Mm-hmm.
It just, like, every time I listen to that song, it just rips me up. And she sells it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
when
she totally
bursts out that, and just, it's just like, to use a phrase, when she flowers open.
Mm-hmm.
It's just every time. I'm like, I'm on the floor. I'm done.
Well, I'm going to have to do Mean Green Mother from Outer Space. You know?
Second that.
Yeah. It is just so powerful.
Yeah.
And because Audrey just literally explodes. It literally explodes.
Yeah.
And it's just awesome. And the music, because the beat actually, like, sets the theme for that whole scene through it. And when, you know, Levi Stubbs is talking to Rick Moranis, he's just talking and, you know, like, the head's going back and forth. And you feel the emotion, like, there is nothing you can do to beat me, you know.
And I love the references to the other 50s
horror movies.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. It's just like, this is a setup to, and an homage to sci-fi monsters at its best.
Yes.
And Audrey was the best of them.
Yep.
And that's what set it.
The original ending, she won.
Yeah.
Audrey won.
Audrey won.
Mm-hmm. That's
Audrey 2, 8, Audrey 1, and 1.
Yeah. Exactly. Seymour gave up.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, in the original ending and in the original story, it's kind of the same. He gets a hatchet in the Corman movie and goes into the plant's mouth to try to kill it from the inside, and
right.
Does not work so well.
No. What about you guys out there? Any?
Okay.
I do agree about Seymour being the Skid Row, but also the Meat Challenge area.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Also on the Broadway player,
I was actually suspended because I didn't know from high school. But to me, that one was really cool because they had a different characters that the dentist played. So yeah, I like that one a lot. And Michelle and Mary.
All the way in the back
so,
room.
Well, I'm Commander.
We're there.
What about you?
No one's talking about Somewhere That's Green.
Somewhere This Green is a great song.
Yeah. The thing that I realized about that song is that there is it kind of reminds me of Buffy, where she just kind of wants a normal life. She had this monologue in the original play that's about living in Levitt Town and just having the same little house just like everybody else.
It's very 50s.
Yeah. And another big part of that is being a well-written female character doesn't have to necessarily mean being a kick-ass, sassy woman. She can want, just to be a housewife and a mom and things like that. She just needs to be very real and vulnerable. And now I'm going to hand it over to you.
I also second meet Sean Harrod because I think it's really important how you see like Seymour's thought process in that song and like how he's justifying the whole murder thing. But I also played Audrey on a stage production, and my favorite part was the Sominex song, which I don't remember if it's in the movie or not.
It's only the play, I think.
Yeah, I like that part because you kind of get the idea that she's been drugged and she's not actually dead. Like, she didn't die and get fed to the plant. She got eaten alive because she was just sleeping and Seymour fed her to the plant while she was alive. And I think that's the darkest part of the whole musical. So.
Well, is everyone buy version of the movie?
Let's all go eat now.
Probably so in the scene more, maybe tossed up a little bit of Dennis, kind of back and forth on those. But I think just in the musical terms, my favorite song is Suppertime.
I was hoping someone would mention Suppertime, because that is a great song. Guy Shrimp and.
Guy Shrimp. My favorite song is probably Beach Down Harrod as well. Even if it's not really in the mood, like, think that one about.
I'm seeing a running theme here of the Meekshell and Harrod.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if this is a wish fulfillment sort of thing.
There's nothing wrong with wanting normalcy.
So my favorite song is probably Skid Row. So if you really want to feel old, I watched this movie for the first time at 5 years old at 1984, and I watched it a few times. And so I hadn't really seen any plays up until that point, stage productions. And in stage productions, it's very common for, these kind of bit parts to walk in and sing a line or two and then jump off. Mm-hmm. And so in Skid Row, you kind of have this whole town talking about how they want to escape. And it was really kind of the first time for me that I saw these extras, these sort of bit parts that really came in and they had something to say. They looked really unique. You think about the lady that starts it, the sort of older lady, and she's carrying some bags. She looks, well-worn, and there's, these homeless guys. There's a guy dumping out some food on the street.
And the food is slop.
So for me, it was kind of like, this is an actual world that's inhabited by
real people.
People that live in this city. And so for me, that was, probably one of the best parts of the story. Really hit me like, this is a universe that I can really get into. So for me, that's probably my favorite song.
Well, I think it was important for them to set the setting not as New York, but Skid Row, New York. Because when everyone thinks of New York, you may go to Manhattan, probably, or Bronx, Queens, like that Archie Bunker thing. But no, we had to go further lower than that to get you to the point of these people are economically desperate and want out of their situation, so murder.
So of course they would feed people to a plant.
Sure. It's
like
plausible
a really
now.
Gross Sesame Street.
Yeah. Avenue ZZZ.
Okay. Now I want to see that. I want to see Audrey talking to Big Bird.
Audrey coming out of the trash can.
There we go. Where's Oscar? Don't ask.
But how do you think I got so large?
That two more. I like Dadu.
It's Dadu.
Yeah, I like Dadu. Without the plant.
Yeah.
That's
yeah. Yes.
Gophery is a very good song.
I guess what we're saying is every song.
It's all good.
And I love the scenes. It was available on CD.
Because I love the scenes because with Rick Moranis' character has all the band-aids on all his fingers where he's like bleeding himself.
He's weak and can't stand up very well.
Got it really.
Actually, I'm changing topics just a little bit. I'm kind of wondering why, looking back at it now, there's so many good names in the film. From Moranis, there was obviously Dan Aykroyd in there, Steve Martin. Where did they get their people? It couldn't have been a good thing for them to have read and go, oh yes, this is something that I must do.
It could have been that.
Well, and I also think, I mean, Frank Oz has a long tradition with with SNL. I mean, he was the guy. He had a cameo in Blues Brothers,
mm-hmm. Nice.
And so he's always. I think he's hung around with them, so he knows them, and as well as and Rick Moranis with SCTV. So you have like the two big comedic powerhouses in the '80s, really kind of pulling resources to be in this movie. So,
and if you're doing a movie in 2 days, you call who you know.
Had a Muppet skit.
Yeah.
Like, it was a variety show back then.
They were all tied together, and they also knew each other through the improv scene, that's how Rick Moranis got involved through Second City. Because he, you know, the Second City people knew the Saturday Night Live people.
Well, a lot of SNL people were poached from Second City.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, they were all tied together already, and, you know, Rick was already starting to do some films. And so, you know, he was, like I said, we said earlier with this SCTV TV show, he was, you know, starting to get very well known, and he was a great get for it.
Yes, Mr. Cowboy.
And Steve Martin had been on the Muppet Show already and had been in the Muppet movie. So
that's true. That's true.
With Frank Oz there. So he was, I believe he was a last minute casting too, if I remember correctly. That was a phone call, I think, that somebody else dropped out.
Yeah, I think I remember hearing that too, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So. What about, we haven't mentioned Bill Murray.
Yeah.
As the sadist.
No, as a masochist. Sorry, it's second day of Dragon Con. I got them confused. That's a bad date set. No, it was still New York.
It's still New York?
Yeah.
Okay, now I'm confused because it might. The main thing I remember from the original in the setting is that there was a train track nearby because the first person Seymour feeds the plant is a hobo who got run over because he passed out on the tracks.
Yeah. I'm almost certain the original was in LA, but I was just wondering.
It might be. It could have been. Now I'm.
If anyone finds out.
Signal, look it up.
Please write Gary at.
Bless you. Bless you.
Please continue this discussion on the Facebook group.
Exactly.
Yes.
So
we've kind of talked favorite moments, favorite song.
Right. Why does the movie last, you know, it's 30 years old now.
That was movie my question.
Exactly. Was. What keeps it fresh? Because anytime I see it on TV, on one of the cable channels, I'm stuck watching it. You know, even if it's like halfway done, I will just stick with it and watch it all the way to the end. There's something. There's only a couple movies out there that'll do it. This
Los
one.
Angeles. Okay, so you were right. Oh, sweet.
See.
Okay.
All right. She gets a no prize.
She gets yes.
You win a free subscription to this podcast.
Well, and I mean, here's how much is when it was on. What's the show on Mogo? I can't remember the name. It's like Drinks in a Movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Dinner.
They did Little Shop of Horror. I stumbled halfway into it. It's like. I know what I'm doing for the next hour.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Maybe because it explores themes that aren't too common in other films and television that is around today, that, you know, maybe that's what's keeping it fresh, that, you know, the themes of kind of morality and, you know,
No.
What would you do to get out of hellhole?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't think of another one made in game.
I also think since it's a period piece, it's not like it takes place, you know, it could be any day now or anything.
Yeah, it's not dated.
It's not dated, exactly. And the music is still...
Aliens, it's just so many things.
It's so stylized that it really takes place in its own, like, little pocket.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
That one and then over here.
Weird is good.
I remember in Roger Ebert's initial review, he even said it would be a cult classic.
Yeah, he was right.
He called it. It has a lot of charm to it.
It's definitely not something you see every day.
Right.
Santa.
Ho, ho, ho.
Going off what they were just saying, I feel like it also has such lasting effect. Kind of like we spoke of earlier, is the music itself and the songs are just so phenomenal. They're super catchy, always stuck in your head. Mm-hmm. I mean, I first saw it for the first time late 90s, early 2000s. I was a young teenager at the time. And I mean, it clicked immediately for me. It was just, I think anyone that kind of grows up into sci-fi or weird monster movies or musical theater just being weird in general, and I tick every single one of those boxes. And anyone that ticks those boxes, it just sticks with you.
Yeah.
And like I said, I personally identified way too much with Seymour as a young geek.
I think in some ways it just personifies what the 80s like really did really well, which is like service all this like horrific, like miserable stuff in a nice poppy like environment with a lot of charm and a lot of humor and a lot of fun and bright colors, and boom, there you go, there's the 80s for you.
Yeah, some nostalgia thrown in. And
hey,
yeah, I think you're onto something with the appealing to so many different populations of musical theater fans, science fiction fans. It really can draw from a lot of different
groups. Well, also, if you look at the sets, they're timeless.
Yeah.
Because they make it look like a Broadway set.
Yeah, it really is its own world, its own universe, because of the fact that it's set. Mm-hmm. And they don't try to make... If someone tried to remake this and make it in New York, it would not
fly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also that music itself is very powerful. Mm-hmm.
A little closer to the microphone.
A little closer to the mic, please. What are your favorites?
It's on.
Sorry.
There you go.
Hey, it's Mary from the Earth Station Who podcast.
Hi, Mary.
Hi. If you've been around people who are experiencing Alzheimer's or forms of dementia, you will notice that they often will remember songs long after they've forgotten almost everything else about their minds. And I remember going to visit a friend's mother in an Alzheimer's facility and walking in there, and a woman was singing suddenly Seymour at the top of her voice.
Oh. Wow.
And it's beautifully.
Yeah.
And she was somebody. She had no other connection to reality anymore. But still, she could remember that. And also, by the way, we just discovered it was set in Los Angeles.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm bummed now for a minute.
By the way, Gary, it was Los Angeles.
Yes.
I said I could be wrong.
We're quite often wrong on this podcast.
Wrong.
Yeah.
And maybe I missed it, but I don't know if we had a chance to really talk about how to make it. And about the fact that this movie is spearheading his career into being able to do what we made with the Little Mermaid.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Darren had mentioned that.
Yeah, absolutely. Macon and Ashley became basically a powerhouse pair. And when you think about when Little Shop came out, there were no movie musicals coming out. Yeah. This wasn't like Chicago, which revived movie musicals, you know, in the aughts. There were no musicals. It was the Disney.
It was a dead genre.
Yeah,
and you would get like one song. Or two songs, and that's it. And then when Disney was like, oh my God, Little Shop is really good, pluck these guys up, throw them in the House of the Mouse,
and then they saved Disney.
Basically saved Disney.
Disney Animation.
Well, if you think about it, though, is before that, at the movies, the last big musical before that was Grease.
Yeah.
And
everything. And that was 70 River.
Yeah.
Actually, there is a great documentary called Waking Sleeping Beauty. I don't know if anybody's
seen it. Absolutely. It's amazing.
But they talked about how Howard Ashman was actually the reason that they turned The Little Mermaid into
a musical.
Yeah.
There is like longer footage of a clip that they show available on YouTube. that is the whole seminar about how movie musicals and animation could work. So I highly recommend watching that, because it, especially if you're a writer or a creative person, because it will inspire you to really stick to your guns about something.
I mean, Disney had Little Mermaid, but before that it was Oliver and Company, which had a few songs with Billy Joel and one of the Pointer Sisters and Bette Midler, which you probably don't remember off the top of your head. Mm-hmm. And then we had The Great Mouse Detective, which had a song with Vincent Price in it. But before that, you had The Rescuers. No song.
Yeah.
And you go all the way through the 70s, you have to go almost back to Jungle Book
for
and Robin Hood to get some Disney musical. We don't talk about that one. So, or even as far back as Mary Poppins, to get a real, true movie musical from Disney. So they went about 15 years without a musical in the sense that you would use today.
And I really think that the main reason it lasts is just that it's... Any children in here? Okay. It's really fracking good.
Yeah.
I mean, the story, the acting, the music, the set... There isn't a single frame of this movie I would change. Either cut.
Mm-mm.
It's just rock solid.
Except for the ending, you know.
Like I said, you can pick your ending of your choice. Both of them are equally solid.
You know,
it's
going to be 20 years. You're going to find out it's like Clue. There's a third ending.
Oh. Well, wait. It could have been this.
I think there is a third ending.
There are three endings on Clue, but yes.
Yeah.
And they get, that's a panel we did last year, so. Over there.
Yay, Cody.
Why?
Scared.
We don't bite too hard.
We're not plants.
We'll negotiate.
Oh. Okay.
I think you're in good company here.
Yes.
We like,
just
the
like
weird
to talk
stuff.
About it.
Oh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think anybody that watches it can really kind of pick some character to associate something with, even if they don't want to admit it to themselves or to anybody else. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Where are dentists?
I can relate to the feeling of wanting to escape the reality that you're in, singing it out, dancing around.
That's awesome.
It's
has anybody ever heard the theory that the whole movie is just a fantasy in Seymour's head? Yeah,
I could buy that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Isn't
that a theory for all
the movies? Yeah. They're all actually, no, they're all in that snow globe in the end of St. Elsewhere.
That makes so much sense, that.
Oh, God, it's all a dream, isn't it?
Exactly.
I think this whole panel... is a dream in
oh, it's a dream within a dream. Mm-hmm.
You dream your way, sir. I will dream mine.
Yeah, the original ending is reality ensues.
Yeah.
As the trope goes.
You wake up and go, oh crap, I'm still in the basement.
Yeah.
With my crappy job. And everyone's still alive,
and
damn it.
What's really amazing to me that we haven't really talked about is, if you think about it, this is a really dark movie. And yet it's very light, it's very happy, it's very up. But when you think about what's going on, you know, a lot of murder and planticide, it's dark.
Again, the through line of the urchins lightens this movie up. If you took the music out of it and took them out of it, holy crap.
Sure, I mean,
no, thank you.
You, have the
you wouldn't sympathize with Seymour,
exactly.
But you totally do. I mean,
yeah.
just as he's justifying what he's doing, you know, these are bad people that I'm getting rid of.
It's like, if you really think about it, Seymour is one of those nice guys. I don't have the courage to actually talk to a lady.
Right. No one at Dragon Con can possibly relate to that.
I identified with Seymour way too much.
All right. We have time for one more question, so you're going to be the last question for right now?
Yeah, last question. Yay. And what's your name?
Chantel.
Into the microphone, please. Sorry. Thank you, Chantel. What's your question?
We love your costume.
With it being more light, that's like, I don't know if
any of
you are familiar with
Sweeney
Todd.
Yes.
Oh,
yeah.
God.
Yeah.
The best musical of all time.
Very difficult to pull off if it wasn't so hilarious.
Yeah.
I identify way too much with Sweeney Todd.
Uh-oh. I'm seeing a theme here. Yes.
You, sir, need a shave.
Yes.
Can I say one more thing?
Sure. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. Yes, yes.
Is because of the way that Rick Moranis played Seymour. He played him very sympathetically and very sweet, whereas in the original stage musical, he was more morally gray. It was, you were more hesitant to sympathize with him. So you kind of accepted it more when you know, got what he had earned.
Yeah, which ties to the original Corman movie where Seymour is not sympathetic at all.
Yeah, but Rick Moranis is and I think that made it harder for the test audiences to see him.
Yeah, that and Americans really hate a downer ending. We love our happy endings.
Yeah, true.
It's annoying.
All right. Game of Thrones.
Yeah, thankfully we're coming around.
Exactly.
But how many people's reactions to so many things in Game of Thrones is... There's a gag I heard of. Why does the Game of Thrones always end on that black screen for 5 seconds so you can see yourself reflected in your device?
with that thought, though, I thought it would be kind of fun to end this with a sing along.
Oh, God.
Yes. So,
Skid Row? We should have asked them.
Better.
You start a town. You put in your hands for the powers that have always been.
Sing it, child.
Till it's fine.
Shelter, a bed, a crust.
just a bread and a job. Treats me like dirt, calls me a slob, which I am. So I live
downtown.
That's your home address. You live
downtown.
When your life's a mess, you live
downtown.
Where depression's just status quo. Show me a way to get out of here. Cause I constantly pray I'll get out of here. Please won't somebody say I'll get out of here. Someone give me my shot or I'll rot here. Show me how and I will, I'll get out of here. I'll start climbing uphill and get out of here. Someone tell me I still could get out of here. Someone tell a lot that I'm stuck here. It sure would be swell to get out of here. If you got a farewell and get out of here. I'd move heaven to hell to get out of here. I know I don't know what to get out of here. But I have a lot to get out of here.
Yeah! Yeah! Thank you, everyone. We are the Earth Station One podcast. You can find it at ESOPodcast.com and up on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. If you liked us, please rate us 5 stars, and we'll come back again next year.
We'll sing something else.
And we'll sing again.
Thanks, gentlemen. DragonCon 2016. The ESO Network. American Sci-Fi Classics.
Thank you.
You sang along. 5 stars. Come on.
You've been listening to Earth Station 1, a weekly podcast that explores the many worlds of all things geek. Please write us at esopodcast@gmail.com or call us at 404-963-9057. And if we find what you say interesting, we'll put it up on the air. If you've enjoyed our show, please rate us or leave feedback for us up on iTunes. And while you're there, subscribe to our show or any of the ESO Network podcasts. We can also be found up on Stitcher Radio or wherever fine podcasts are found. ESO is also available up on most social media sites like Facebook, Twitter, and so many more. The show is brought to you by the fine folks at the ESO Amazon.com e-store, where right from our website you can find all kind of geeky goodness. And if you get something up there, you also help support the station. ESO also has a Zazzle store to buy cool ESO merchandise and such. Show your ESO love with something from Zazzle. To learn more about ESO, our website is esopodcast.com. The show is produced by Calico Productions. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you here next time on the Earth Station 1 podcast. Peace.
Hi, bye, boys.
Have fun storming the castle.
Think it'll work?
Bye-bye. Bye.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.